Hi, Greg. How you doing?
All right, how you doing?
Pretty good. Do you have any insight to somebody who lives in New York and is a union worker on this strike that we're not getting out of the mainstream media?
Well, basically, for many years, since the last strike in April of 1980, the MTA has been trying to reduce the standard of living of transit workers. They've been doing what they call broadbanding, which is a fancy way of saying combining jobs. And they have been, in general, attacking the standard of living of transit workers. And so this is really the first effective resistance that union has put up in a quarter of a century. And I think it's great that they did it. I mean, they were heroic enough to launch an illegal strike. And they took the risk. And I think the only tragedy is that the leadership of Local 100 returned to work without a contract. I think that was a great strategic error on their part. But other than that, the fact that they even moved at all, that the members pushed their union to walk out like that, I think was a great thing.
Yeah, I believe there is a tradition with them of not working without a contract, isn't there?
Well, there was prior to April 1980.
Oh, okay.
There have been, over the last few agreements, in the 80s and in the 90s, where they would work often quite extended periods of time without a contract. I believe in 89 it was over 3 months.
Oh, no kidding.
So they have, that's the kind of, that tradition has degraded over the years.
Mm.
And this is an example, and even this time they worked 3 days without a contract.
Yeah, and what was the penalty for that under the Taylor Act? Or
Taylor Law.
The Taylor Law.
Basically, just to give you a little history lesson, in 1947, New York State passed a law called the Condon-Wanlon Act that prohibited public employee strikes, and you'd get fired if you went on strike. Well, in 1966, New Year's Day in 1966, Transport Workers Union challenged that. They stayed on strike 12 days. They got an amnesty. So they kept their jobs. They actually had to repeal the Condon-Wanlon Act because they defied it so massively. And we got the Taylor Law in 1967, which said that if you went on strike, you would get fined 2 days' wages for every day on strike, and there's also provisions for the state Supreme Court to impose injunctions with more severe penalties than that. Now, at present, the way what's on the table right now is the state Supreme Court judge in Brooklyn, who's been handling this case, he's imposed a $1 million a day fine on Local 100, so a total of $3 million in fines. There are two smaller amalgamated transit union locals that are also involved. They got smaller fines, $50,000 and $75,000 per day. And the individual workers get fined two days' wages for every day they spend on strike, so 6 days' pay.
Wow.
And that is currently the fines as they stand. There are many militant transit workers who are demanding that they fight for an amnesty like they did in 66, which they actually got. And the local has kind of pushed for that, but I get the impression they're not going to fight for it. They're basically just going to make the folks pay.
Ooh, man.
And that's unfortunate. So.
Yeah, that's a real bite.
Yeah.
okay, well, maybe we need to get into the basic issues of the strike. The big thing that we've been seeing in the media out here in the heartland is about the pension issue.
Okay, well, you know, that's one thing that's been distorted even in the media here in New York. The real big issue that nobody's talking about, but if you ask people to work for transit, it's a big issue, is something called broadbanding. Now, what's broadbanding? Basically, there are different job titles or crafts within transit: conductors, train operators, station agents, station cleaners, bus operators, bus maintainers, etc. Transit wants to eliminate the higher paying of those jobs and make people do other people's jobs in addition to their own. Like in our subway trains, we have a train operator who drives a train, and incidentally, that position requires, you got to spend a year in school before you drive a train.
Wow.
Because these things go 70 miles an hour. The train, they weigh 40 tons each car. So it's, and you're going through crowded platforms, you really got to know what you're doing. You got to work the transit at least 3 years before they even let you go to school to learn how to drive a train. Well, they want to make the train operators also be the conductor. The conductor is the person that opens the doors. They're also the people that call the police if you get attacked on the train. They're also the people that if you get run over by a train, they got to go down on the roadbed, the track, and help the paramedics take your body off the track. And yeah, that involves, our trains are electrified. There's this thing called the third rail that has 600 volts of electricity in it.
Yeah.
That's what powers the train. Maybe your listeners have never seen a New York subway track. You climb down the roadbed, you can be standing like maybe 5-6 inches from that thing. You get too close, forget about it. Bam, you're dead like that. So
yeah.
That is what can, they want to make the train operator also do the conductor's job as well as their own job. And some of the train lines, they actually experimented with something called OPTO, one-person train operation, where they had a train that didn't have a conductor on it. Generally, these were subway lines that operated in the poorer and more heavily black and Latino parts of our city, such as the in northern part of Brooklyn, where on the G train and the L train, they have done this. So basically, they've been trying to do this for years. Also, they've been trying to make in the stations, to make the station agents, the people that sell the Metro cards, our fare cards, they've been trying to make them also clean the station and also have them come outside of the armored booths where they sell the fare cards from and be like glorified tour guides. And they want some of the booths they want to eliminate altogether and just make you buy the Metro card from the vending machines, which are very unreliable, and you might lose your money, and you got to write a letter to get a refund. And basically, that's essentially one of the big things. It's also as far as the skill trades, their in-house construction workforce. They've been using us, folks in the building trades, to do their work because they got to pay their in-house people 40 hours wages a week every week of the year. They bring us in. They hire us for the exact number of hours they need to do the job. Then the contractor lays us off. So that's another issue. A lot of this stuff has been completely buried in corporate media accounts of this struggle. But above all, broadbanding and the gradual elimination of many jobs. And I didn't even get into the issue of using people on work release, people who are under court-ordered community service and welfare recipients in the workfare program, which we call WEP here in New York City, using them to clean the stations instead of the station cleaners. And that's another issue. And also they've been using them in place of car cleaners, the people that clean the subway cars at the end of the line. So basically, they plan to eliminate several thousand jobs, and that's a big issue. No one's talked about it, but it's a very important thing.
By the way, these people you're talking about, say like the work release people,
yeah.
What do they get paid?
Nothing.
Oh.
Okay. Same thing with the people on community service, same thing with the people on WEP. It's basically forced labor. It's like the chain gang in the old days, but they revived it.
Yeah.
Except instead of a chain, they have you wear a blue vest so you can be identified as being a work release or a community service prisoner, if you will.
Amazing.
And they make them clean the stations for nothing.
Oh, man. And I imagine that is quite a chore.
Yeah, well, we have 7 million passengers per day. The system is grossly understaffed, so the stations do get quite filthy.
Okay. Well,
and it snows here a lot, and it gets quite rainy, so that also contributes to the platforms getting dirty as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, what is the deal with the pension?
Well, the deal with the pension is, once upon a time, everybody in transit had one pension where you retired after 20 years, just like the cops, just like the firefighters. They lost that in 1980. They got a four-tier pension plan. The bottom tier, tier one, tier two, tier three, tier four. Bottom tier, tier four, which the majority of people currently in the system who were hired after 1980 got put into, you got to work for 25 years till age 55 to get a pension. Now, transit's a difficult job. They breathe in a lot of steel dust. They're working on the tracks next to the third rail. Even at 55, most of them die a couple of years after they retire. So basically what they want to do is create a new tier, tier 5. In tier 5, you'd have to work till 62 to get a pension. And, oh, yeah. Prior to 1980, nobody paid for the pensions. After 1980, Tier 2, Tier 3, Tier 4, they have to pay 2%. They want to make the Tier 5 people, who are people who haven't been hired yet, pay 6%. Roger Toussaint, the head of the transit union, referred to that as selling out the unborn, and he refused to go along with it. And that's the that issue, for technical legal reasons, that's been the main thing the union's been emphasizing officially. But I think the broadbanding thing is a bigger issue, but the pension thing, that's basically the issue about the pensions.
Okay, yeah.
And also there's an issue about health insurance as far as them the transit authority trying to take away, they reduce the health coverage and make people pay more for less coverage. That's also been endlessly emphasized in the anti-union propaganda. The Daily News, the Post, and the TV stations, they'll get people to come out and say, oh, well, I don't have health insurance on my job. Why do they have health insurance on this?
Yeah, that's something I was looking through a few articles just before I called, and I was seeing that some columnists playing up the almost class warfare within the working class.
Yeah.
And why should I be paying taxes for this? And
which is ironic because New York reporters are members of the Newspaper Guild of the Communication Workers of America. They get health insurance. That's the irony. They get, and the Newspaper Guild of Greater New York, their plan is a very good plan. So really, they leave that out because that wouldn't fit in with the propaganda.
Yes, correct. Well, anyway, you're... before I started recording, you were talking about there's kind of a racial issue along with all this strike.
Well, yes, because you see, the Transit Authority was the first big agency in New York to integrate. Back in 1941, there was a big struggle led by the Transport Workers Union and the Communist Party and Adam Clayton Powell, who was the congressman from Harlem, that forced the Transit Authority, which was then a group of private companies, to integrate, and that was one of the first good-paying jobs in New York that became open to African-American workers. And to this day, the authority is very heavily black. It's like the workforce is about 70% black and Latino. There are also large numbers of Asian workers, you know, from India and China and so forth. Also, many of the white workers are immigrants from Europe, in particular Russian Jews. So it's a very heavily minority and immigrant workforce. Roger Toussaint, the leader of the TWU, as you know, he's African. Well, he's a black man. He is an immigrant from Trinidad. And basically, in predominantly black parts of the city, like Harlem, where I live, because this was like the first big job that they opened up to us in New York, there's widespread sympathy for the union, irregardless of whatever personal inconvenience we might have. We might have to walk a mile to get to work because, you know, New Yorkers don't drive. I don't have a driver's license. I'm 37 years old. That's very common here in New York City. We take the subway or the bus. But even despite the sacrifices, like, this is what we have to do to defend this good job. Among Latinos, there's also somewhat less of the support, but still, that's a good job. It's something that we recognize. They recognize the importance of fighting to preserve that job. Now, among white New Yorkers who live within the city limits, they tend to disproportionately be wealthy people. Working class whites tend to live further out in Westchester, Long Island, Jersey, etc. So among the upper class whites, your stockbrokers, your Wall Street executives, people like the people who like Mike Bloomberg's neighbors, people like that, they resent the fact that you have, you know, black people with high school diplomas making 50 G's a year. That offends them on some visceral racial level. So there's been this tremendous hostility towards these workers. I mean, on the TV, you'll see, like, white stockbrokers saying, oh, they should do what Ronald Reagan did and fire them all. And, it got so ugly, the Transport Workers Union had to take down their weblog because they were getting all this racist hate mail.
Well, now, I was just reading an article about that, and there was no mention of racist hate comments, but a lot of just, oh, they attract a lot of anti-union comments, and basically,
oh, no,
sort of
they
backfired.
Were explicitly racial. I mean, they were calling people monkeys. They were calling people, you people, which, as you know, is a euphemism. It was quite clear the comments were transparently racial. Now, maybe the writer soft-pedaled that, but the fact was, it was racial.
Yeah, and then there was another little kerfluffle in here where, I don't know, I guess Mayor Bloomberg got out the anti-labor dictionary or thesaurus and started pulling words out of that.
Oh, yeah, well, he did call, he called Roger Toussaint a thug, which besides being an anti-labor thing, I don't know how familiar your listeners are with Roger Toussaint. He's a college-educated man. He was a college radical back home in Trinidad before he came here. He went to Brooklyn College here in New York, very educated, well-spoken man, very thoughtful, Very respectable gentleman. I mean, incidentally, you see him on TV, he conducts himself like a gentleman. You see Bloomberg and Pataki on TV, they're yelling like idiots. And then they called him a thug, which besides being ridiculous, if you've actually seen Roger Toussaint, it's also, especially these days, that's kind of a code word for any assertive black male is a thug.
Yeah.
A criminal. So it's obviously not only had an anti-union connotation, it went in the gutter. I mean, it's Councilman Charles Barron, he's a city councilman from East New York, Brooklyn, he explicitly said that, you know, the problem that some people had was this was a black union taking on a white billionaire. He actually said that in a speech he made on the last day of the strike at a rally of the strikers. And I would have to agree with Councilman Barron on that.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing how things like Katrina, you know, these big city problems are playing themselves out in a manner which really exposes the continuing racism in American society, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, beyond the racial problem is another thing, too. TWU has historically, since the union was founded in 1934, it set the pace for city worker wages. Now, all the other city unions have had their wages and conditions gradually whittled down. Like, for instance, there have been widespread pay cuts for new hires. That kind of thing, that's kind of how they tend to introduce pay cuts among city workers here.
Oh,
well, if you work
tiers.
Here now, you keep your pay, but the people we're going to hire tomorrow are going to have a lower standard of living. Again, it's commonly known among civil service unions here as selling out the unborn. And they really have emphasized that heavily here, and they really wanted to make a point of pushing this through with the TWU because, and the argument you hear is, well, the other unions accepted it. Well, AFSCME took it. Well, the police took it, the firefighters, the teachers. Why are these guys holding out? And it's unfortunate that there's been such disunity here. I mean, I myself feel that we should have called a general strike in support of the transport workers. Look, there was widespread sympathy for the transport workers among much of the city's workforce. In fact, I would say among union members, it was almost universal. And frankly, it would have made an impact. Because as it was, just because of the sheer logistical difficulties of getting to work, half the city's workforce didn't even show up to work anyway. We have about 4 million people work in New York City. 2 million of us didn't even go to work this week. And if they had, you know, formalized that into a general strike, it would have made an impact. Because then it wouldn't have been, oh, look at these transit workers inconveniencing the commuters. It would have been, you know what? Their fight's our fight. We're all staying home. The streets are empty.
Yeah, look at the community. You know, working for the transport workers.
And exactly.
I was just wondering, was there any type of outreach before the strike to develop support for the workers? Or
unfortunately, no. I mean, really, the extent of TWU's outreach were once the strike jumped off, they handed out flyers at some of the bridges where people were walking across to get into Manhattan, and also they had television commercials on our all-news cable network, New York One. And that was kind of it. And they had, you know, they really didn't reach out to other unions. The other unions didn't reach out to them either. Our Central Labor Council offered, set up a fund to get other union members to donate money to them. And that was kind of it. I mean, once it jumped off, also it didn't help that their international union, the Transport Workers Union, once the strike started, they repudiated it and ordered everybody to go back to work. That was really very destructive.
Well, yeah, that probably also helps keep other unions from supporting them also.
Exactly. So it's well, oh, the TWU doesn't support them. So it really was very destructive. It was a betrayal on the part of Michael Bryan, the international president of the TWU. And even more amazing because Local 100 is the biggest local in that union. And the international union actually rents its office space in the local union's offices on the west side of Manhattan. So that's ironic that they would stab their biggest local in the back, and they literally have the same offices. So that was pretty pathetic and disgusting, I would have to say. But beyond that, even the unions that rhetorically supported them, like the teachers, like the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, like the like all the other unions, they didn't do anything beyond rhetoric and a bit of money and speaking at the rallies. Like, you know, the SEIU, they rhetorically supported it. Dennis Rivera, who's the head of the hospital union here, Local 1199, the biggest SEIU local in the country, oh, there was lip service. There was, oh, yeah, we support you, which is not a bad thing. I don't want to criticize that, but, you know, talk is cheap. And certainly it would have been helpful if there had been more than just a bit just rhetoric. And especially once the fines started getting imposed. You know, once they started getting the injunctions, it would have been nice if, like, oh, you want to fight them, or you're going to fight every union in New York. We have 1.5 million union members in New York City. So about 12% of the union members in the country are right here in this city. So if we drew a line in the sand here, it would have been not only had an impact here, would have had an impact throughout the United States. And in many ways, and echoes of it would have been felt around the industrialized world. So it was a great opportunity for there to be a line drawn in the sand, and that didn't happen, and that was very unfortunate.
Well, yeah, and also those other unions might look down the road to their next contract and think about how such concerted action will help them in the future.
Oh, yeah, like, you know, my union, the New York District Council of Carpenters, our contract comes up July 1st, 2006. So certainly it's going to have an impact on us. And, you know, and there's another thing, too, with the building trades. I mean, among construction workers, we have a long tradition here of you know, solidarity. Certainly everybody I spoke to was sympathetic with the transport workers and would have been willing to even, you know, even do a sympathy strike. But the building trades were still mad with Local 100 because when we were supposed to, when we put in our bid for the Olympics, the building trades, of course, supported building a stadium here, and they supported it. TWU didn't. They thought it was a waste of money. And it also involved, for technical budgetary reasons, involved basically the MTA subsidizing the Olympic bid. And that really wasn't very constructive. And I think the TWU took the right position on that. But, of course, the building trades follow lockstep behind what the real estate developers want, irregardless of if it's in the interest of the working class in New York City. So that was another thing that was trotted out as a petty excuse not to support Local 100. And again, that was unfortunate, and it was destructive. It hurt the broader interests of the working class as a whole.
Yeah, and something I've noticed about this in recent years is in Europe, it seems particularly in France, the transport workers have taken quite a lead in trying to protect really a lot of the same benefits. In Europe, there's a lot going on about pensions now.
Exactly, and that's something, again, could have been a point issue here. There's another thing. Speaking of transport worker solidarity, New York City, we have many taxi cabs, and because we don't drive here, when you do have a situation where you need to take a car somewhere, you know, you get a cab. In Midtown and downtown Manhattan and at the airports, you have the yellow cabs, which are mainly driven by immigrants from India and the Middle East. And in neighborhoods like mine, like the working-class neighborhoods in Upper Manhattan, Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, we have what are called livery cars. And the drivers of those cars are mostly immigrants from the Dominican Republic or from West Africa.
Yeah, I've seen now, all the stereotypes on television.
Well, yeah, well, indeed, those are based on fact. It is mainly an immigrant job because it's a low-paying job. And it's that's why it's mainly a job that immigrants get. And it's... But they have unions, and they are not officially recognized by anybody, but they do have unions. And of the three major taxi driver unions in New York City, two of them unequivocally supported the transport workers. The New York Taxi Workers Alliance, which represents yellow cab drivers, and the United Drivers of America, which is one of the two unions that represents the livery cab drivers, they went out and put their they put their necks in the line and supported the strike because they were supposed to help scab on the bus drivers. They were supposed to use their cabs as substitutes for bus service, and they refused. They said, we'll pick up our regular fares, but we are not going to go out of our way to provide to scab on the bus drivers. We refused to do that because, you know, the city makes an enormous amount of money levying fines on cab drivers, and they normally are subject to quite a bit of police abuse. But all of a sudden, oh, we need you. So we're going to not give you fines. Like, You can get, like, for relatively minor things, you can get a $400 fine for nothing if you're a cab driver, which is what they make in, which is what they make in a week. You could lose that in one day from a ticket. So the cab, they basically said, you know what? We support TWU, and we are not going to scab. And frankly, if the other unions in New York City had followed the line, had followed the path blazed by the Taxi Workers Alliance and by the United Drivers of America, you know, these two small immigrant-led unions, they don't have any money, they're not AFL-CIO unions, they don't have official NLRB recognition, but they, that should have been, every other union in New York should have responded. We refuse to scab, we're going to help these guys, we're going to help the transit workers win. So that would have been, that's a model for what everybody else could have and should have done.
Well, Greg, I think we're getting short on time here. I was just wondering, do you have any prognosis for the future on this?
Well, the problem is, and as many transit workers have pointed out, and also as many other unionists have pointed out, they went back to work with no contract. They don't even have an amnesty from the Taylor Law fines. And right now they're negotiating in the Grand Hyatt Hotel under a media blackout, which means that the workers have no idea what kind of deal is being signed behind their backs. They won't know until they're asked to vote on it. And who knows what kind of deal they're going to get. It's probably not what they could have got if they'd stayed out. And I think the great tragedy is they should have stayed out until they got an amnesty and an end to broadbanding and an end to all the pension cutbacks. And the rest of us should have walked out in solidarity with them.
Well, I hope people take this for a lesson in the future in New York and the rest of the country. And I want to thank you a lot, Greg, for taking your time out to let us know what's really going on there.
No, not a problem. You're quite welcome, brother.
Okay. Well, happy holidays to you.
You too.